CityTalk 105.9 official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. CityTalk 105.9.
Hello and welcome to City Talk's Business with me, Frank McKenna. I'm the chairman of the Independent Private Sector Lobby Group and Business Networking Club Downtown Liverpool in Business. And every Sunday, I take a look at some of the week's big business stories and talk to some key personalities, decision makers and entrepreneurs who work in and influence Liverpool and the wider northwest region. Liverpool will launch its very own embassy in London on Friday. How will this help the city attract investors and assist in the promotion of the image of Liverpool? VAT is up, student fees are up and quangos have been culled. But are the government's announced changes actually going to cost the country and the Treasury money? And talking of the government, what can business expect from our politicians, both locally and nationally, in 2011? To discuss this and more, I'm sure, I'm joined this week by the Managing Director of Aurora Media, John Egan, and Liverpool City Council Cabinet Member for Employment and Skills, Councillor Nick Small. John, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, Frank.
How's life
at... Happy New Year to the listeners.
Absolutely. How's life at Aurora then?
Well, you know, touch wood, or Formica in the case of Radio City's studio. It's so far so good, although it is the beginning of the year. And, you know, I think anybody in business would be foolish to set out with too many ambitions. It's a very uncertain landscape that we're all looking into at the moment, or trying to traverse.
Do you think it is going to be a tough year for business?
I think inevitably it's going to be a tough year for business. I think there are so many fundamental uncertainties about how the impact of government policy is going to impact on the economy, particularly in terms of this part of the world. You know, massive cuts in local in public expenditure, which will inevitably have a huge impact on the level of demand in the local economy. There's going to be less money spent. And consequently, I think every business will have to deal with a very uncertain environment.
I remember when we discussed this last year, and you and I and others were discussing some of the changes that the government were planning to implement, and obviously the implementation of those plans is upon us. Economists are now saying that this VAT increase, which Treasury officials were predicting will generate somewhere in the region of £13 billion, might actually not get anywhere near that figure, because potentially the VAT rise will stymie spending. And anyway, because so much money is being taken out of the economy via those public sector cuts which you mentioned, people simply aren't going to have the money to spend, and therefore the VAT take will not be anywhere near what those projections are.
I think that's it's not entirely surprising, and I suppose I'm a little bit of an old-fashioned, unreconstructed Keynesian, because, you know, when I did economics, that was the standard orthodoxy, that if you reduce the amount of money in the economy, people spend less and tax revenues go down. And that was the fundamental issue, I think, that was being debated at the time of the last general election between two very different economic prescriptions. And I think perhaps to some extent the criticism of this coalition government's approach has tended to focus on the fact, well, it's not very fair. I think the more pertinent, more fundamental question is, well, it could perhaps end up being not very fair and not very effective as well. And I think that is the danger. But yeah, you're quite right. I mean, if you're taxing consumption, and consumption is being suppressed due to other instruments of economic policy, then the likelihood is that your projected tax take is going to be considerably less than would otherwise be the case.
And I know the last government took some criticism for the changes they implemented to VAT with the reduction to 15%. People were saying, well, what a waste of time that is. And there was a bit of an inconvenience to business. You will know that yourself as a business owner. But nonetheless, it did actually do the trick. It did stimulate an awful lot of increased spend.
It was a part of a stimulus package that did actually take the economy out of recession. And, you know, it seems a bit feeble to be trying to rehabilitate the economic reputation of the last Labour government. But given the kind of global context in which they were operating, the fact that they were actually, they were successful in getting the UK economy out of recession at a time of, you know, profound economic uncertainty across the globe, is perhaps something that they should have been given a wee bit of credit for. And if it turns out that we either into a double dip recession or that growth just simply flattens out at around zero for the remainder of this year and next year, then you know perhaps we'll look fondly back on the good old days of Gordon Brown and his remarkably you know, good stewardship of the UK economy.
Wouldn't that be a turnaround? And again, we've discussed this before, and I know you've got strong views on student fees. And again, apparently the changes that are going to be implemented in terms of how students are going to be expected to pay those fees back, it could end up that we have a system being created that is going to cost the taxpayer more.
Yeah, I think it's one of those. It's another instance, I think, where you begin to wonder what the government's actual driver was, and to some extent, are they using the cover of a deficit problem and an acute deficit problem, and I don't think anybody's pretending that it's anything other than what it is, but using that cover to do things which actually stem from quite different motives and are fundamentally about ideology. And I think the idea of creating a kind of market mechanism in education is something which they are, which the Conservative Party appears to be wedded to, irrespective of whether there is actually any economic or revenue benefits in switching to a higher level of fees for students. But it is this lack of economic consistency. If we're trying to kind of build an economic narrative around a knowledge economy, high skills, high value, you know, competing at the very top end of the kind of global Premier League of economies, then, you know, we should be trying to replicate what the Pacific Rim economies and the advanced European economies are doing. And they are turning out far more graduates than we are even today. And any instrument of policy that can only, you know, suppress the inclination and the numbers of people attending universities seems to me to be, you know, clearly contradictory in terms of the kind of economy we're trying to build.
Universities, I think, are concerned as well that the market is now going to be open to private educators. Potentially there's going to be, apparently, there's already been some interest expressed from America and elsewhere coming in and doing degree courses at obviously cheaper rates than universities can provide. I suppose there is an argument, though, John, that people would put forward to say that actually universities, in the old-fashioned sense of the way you and I perhaps would view them, have lost somewhat of their way in terms of credibility, simply because there's that many universities now. So, I mean, I don't know. How many have we got in this city? Is it four now? JMU, Hope,
depends where the city boundaries finish. But Edge Hill kind of comes into the city region, and, I suppose,
and
it's four.
So I suppose, in a sense, I've got some sympathy with that, because I do think we just got carried away with that whole what the university experience and the word university. You know, you don't go for university, somehow you're a failure. And there are other ways in which people can be educated. But nonetheless, I do get the sense that some of these initiatives, VAT being one, student fees another, are simply being seen as good headlines.
Yeah.
And they're not being thought through particularly well.
I think that's possibly true. And I think there is a kind of year zero aspect to this government that they do think that in some respects it's just about sacrificing, you know, the old shibboleths and coming out with things which are just, in a sense, signify how radical they're going to be and how they're not tied to any sort of, you know, to history or to tradition, and they're showing their newness. And it's this dangerous fixation with newness, which I think is probably the most corrosive aspect of our politics, because it was something that the last Labour government exhibited as well, that, in a sense, government's legitimacy depends on the extent to which they are completely tearing up the rule book and throwing away all existing orthodoxies and building a brave new world. And it strikes me that any society that doesn't value the accumulated wisdom, knowledge, experience and expertise of those who have gone before us is probably heading towards a dangerous precipice. And I think this government have become equally fixated with this notion about presenting themselves as being something that's radically different to politics that we've ever known in any previous government. And to that extent, anybody that comes along with an idea which is half-baked, well, the less well-baked it is, clearly the more attractive it must be on that very criteria. So there is this danger that some very bizarre and flimsy ideas become kind of the enthusiasms of government, and we end up suffering the consequences. Yeah. But just coming back to your idea about education and universities, you know, maybe you've hit upon something there, and maybe one of the agendas that the government are actually trying to address in a subtle kind of way is, well, actually, we do want to reduce the number of people going to universities. Mm. You know, we just don't think university is for everybody, yeah, yeah. And we'd like to get back to a situation where there were fewer of them and they were more academic and it was middle class people that went to them and they came out with proper degrees, and those degrees led to proper jobs and this whole kind of sort of parallel economy that's been created in these kind of trendy liberal subjects, which generally lead people towards all kinds of dangerous, heretical, leftish
PR,
ideas. Like, exactly. You know, the fewer people that even get into those sorts of areas and subjects, the better, because it really just leads to the moral corruption of youth.
Mm. In analysis of them trying to create a brave new world without actually thinking through the consequences of what they're doing certainly chimes with the findings that are now being produced regarding the abolition or the culling of quangos. Now, the one that I know best was in this region, the Northwest Development Agency. And again, you know, the headline figure was, this will save X millions of pounds. In fact, again, the analysis now is that actually those sort of that abolition, because of the costs of redundancies and the schemes that will be lost and so on and so forth, will actually potentially cost the taxpayers of the Northwest and the UK money. So I think that, as I say, your analysis of they're not really thinking through the consequences of some of their actions.
Mm. But I think the thing about the Tories is that there is a kind of visceral perversion to Tory ideology, and I'm sorry Tony's not here to debate the issue. But the Tories are obsessed with sacrifice. The Tories do believe that when the economy's not working well, when we've sinned against the forces of economic nature, what you've actually got to do is carry out some kind of blood sacrifice to placate these forces. And Thatcher, you know, took this rather literally, in that what you had to do was sacrifice millions of people in terms of their economic livelihood. I think this Tory government have thought, well, actually, if we just find a few sacrificial victims in the quangocracy, because these people, you know, clearly have sinned against nature, because they're just being paid huge public, you know, salaries paid for by taxpayers, but they're not contributing anything to the economic good. And there is this notion that somehow there is a bloodlust, and that Eric Pickles is the kind of high priest of this cult. And that, you know, what you've got to do is lay a few bureaucrats out on a sacrificial table and split them from here to here to demonstrate that you understand the lessons of how economies work and how the forces of nature operate.
I mean, you know, when I talk about the agency, I include within that Business Link, and we're going to have now Business Link replaced basically with an online service.
Yeah.
Which just seems to me crazy, you know, in comparison to the quality that was starting to emerge from Business Link
to what
we're going to be left with. And, you know, couldn't agree more really with what you say there about actually not accepting the value of some of these organisations. But moving on to the wider political agenda of May for 2011, because obviously locally we're still relatively new as a city as far as the Labour administration is concerned. The government are going to introduce a paper, we understand, that promotes elected mayors in cities. And I think, actually, the idea now is that Joe Anderson, the existing leader of the city, will become the mayor, the elected mayor, pro tem, before a referendum can be held. Now, we, Downtown Liverpool, produce a quarterly magazine. In this month's magazine, you've actually written an article as to why you think elected mayors are a good thing, a force for good.
Yeah, and I'm worried by this idea that somebody uncharitably referred to as the mutant mayor model, which is you have a mayor but you don't actually get to vote
for them. Power, yeah.
But somebody just inherits mayoral
power. Yeah,
and it seems to be that it's the worst of all worlds, really. And I'm sure it's the last thing that Joe wants. In fact, I have heard him say quite categorically that it isn't what he wants. He was elected as a council leader. That's his mandate. And if there's going to be a mayoral system, then, you know, whether or not he thinks that's the right way forward or not, I think what he does accept is that anybody who is the mayor should be elected to that position. So I'm worried by this kind of the way in which this is being approached, because I think you're discrediting the proposition before you have the referendum as to whether you want one or not. And I think you're already sullying it. And it's beginning to look like a bit of a fix. It's beginning to look like a bit of an imposition. And it's beginning to look as if the governments are actually trying to fix it. And as somebody who actually believes in elected mayors, I don't want the government to get involved in trying to fix it and to try to introduce it by the back door or to undermine the democratic legitimacy of the office before it's even been created. But no, I do think that having a directly elected mayor for Liverpool would be beneficial in a whole variety of ways in terms of giving the city a profile, visibility, focus, engaging more people in the political process by making democracy more transparent. And I think it would give whoever became the elected mayor, whether it was Joe or somebody else, I think they would have enormous authority based on the power of a direct mandate, which they currently don't have. And I think one of the frustrating things that Joe has to deal with is simply that there are organisations within the city and city region that he finds it very difficult to influence, because at the end of the day, his mandate is indirect. And he doesn't have the same degree of authority and that he would have as if he had several 80, 90, 100,000 votes in his back pocket.
You mentioned there the legitimacy of the elected mayor being an important aspect of the process. You've always been confident that should the issue be taken to referendum in Liverpool, the people of Liverpool will vote yes, we want an elected mayor. But you seem to be suggesting that actually, if the government try and go about this in the wrong way, they may actually see the whole thing backfire on them.
Yeah, I think if you want to make an idea unpopular in Liverpool, wrap it in blue paper.
And
if this is being seen as being, a Tory idea or an idea that's been sort of packaged up by the Tories in a way that's trying to sort of almost force it down people's throats before they've had a chance to make their minds up about it, then I think people will be suspicious of it. And that, to me, is the danger, that, the kind of cack-handed way in which Mr. Pickles has packaged this thing up is in danger of undermining it. But I just don't necessarily think the Tories get democracy. And therefore, I don't think he's particularly worried about the way in which it's been implemented and how it might have that impact.
It's going to be an interesting debate. And just before we go to the break, John, quickly, nationally, how do you see the picture panning out? We've got the Labour Party conference here in Liverpool in September. Ed Miliband, I think it's fair to say, has got off to a wobbly start as leader. And there are some tensions beginning to emerge between the coalition partners. How do you think the national scene is going to pan out?
That's just incredibly difficult. I think putting Ed Miliband to one side for a minute, I think the tensions inside the coalition, it's difficult to see how they're going to be eased over the coming months. And I think the huge supreme test for the coalition and the Lib Dems' appetite for coalition will be the May local elections and what impact that has on the Lib Dems. How many seats do they lose? They're a party with a very considerably smaller membership base than the other two parties. There's a disproportionate number of their members who are actually councillors, and there's a definite propensity amongst Liberal Democrats councillors who lose their seats to go back to doing what they were doing before they became councillors. They'll probably be so decimated in the local elections that the intimations of mortality will take over and that the coalition could be extremely pressurised.
Well, on that note, we are at time for a break. Afterwards, we'll be joined by Councillor Nick Small, the Liverpool City Council Cabinet Member for Employment and Skills. Please stay with us.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
Well, welcome back to the show. We're joined in the studio this week by John Egan from Aurora Media. And I'm delighted that we've now been joined by Councillor Nick Small, who's the Cabinet Member for Employment and Skills at Liverpool City Council. Welcome, Nick.
Hi, Frank.
Good morning to you. Nick, before the break, John and I were discussing the issue of elected mayors. It's something that I think it's fair to say both John and I see the value in. What, as a local politician, do you see the sort of pros and cons of that particular role?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's some pros in there, but I just don't think the people of Liverpool really want it. It's not an issue that, you know, people raise with me. I don't think there's any great appetite for change either within the Labour group or within the Liberal Democrat Party. And I think it's going to be difficult if, you know, and we don't know what the government are going to do. But, you know, I think there needs to be a referendum somewhere down the line. And I think it's going to be difficult to see how the people of Liverpool would vote for it.
John was making the point, I think, very fairly, that it's going to be an even more difficult sell if it's something that the Conservative Party is promoting, because, of course, in this city, they've got no representation on the council or indeed within Westminster.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not opposed to mayors, but I think, you know, it's different in each city. And, you know, I don't think there's any big appetite for change in Liverpool. I think, you know, Joe's done a brilliant job since we took control of the council in May. And I don't really think people want to change that. What people are against, though, is you're right, is a Conservative government trying to impose a solution on Liverpool. I think some of the things that's been coming out of from Eric Pickles about this around, you know, shadow mayors and having a confirmatory referendum, I just don't think the people of Liverpool are going to buy that. There's no appetite there.
Yeah, I think as an advocate of elected mayors, that was one of your fears, John.
Well, absolutely. It just undermines the legitimacy of the thing before it's even come into being. And if it's seen as being some kind of Tory stitch up, it's going to make it very hard for those of us who are long-standing supporters of the idea to sell it.
And I think, in fairness to both John and myself, and in fact many other people out there who probably are in favour of elected mayors, there is a recognition, I think, that certainly since we had a full-time political leader, there's been a notable difference in terms of the engagement with the wider business community from the city's leadership. And equally, that Joe Anderson is doing a good job. I think the point that those of us who are in favour of elected mayors would make is that how much more effective Joe Anderson could be if he had that wider electorate support.
So I see the point you're making. I mean, I'm agnostic on the issue. I think, you know, we've got to get on with the job in hand in Liverpool, which is, you know, changing the way services are run and changing how we work with the business community. I think Joe's done a really good job on that. I'm not going to get bogged down about structures and, you know, elected mayors and leader of the council. I think what's important is we have the right person in place to deliver the kind of change that Liverpool needs.
Okay, well, you mentioned there, Nick, in terms of the challenges that the City Council face, and I've mentioned that your specific responsibility is employment and skills, which must be a very big agenda at this moment in time. Can you just explain to the listeners what that role entails?
Yeah, I mean, I'm responsible for expenditure around about 80 million a year with the council. It ranges from post-16 education, adult learning service, the jobs and education and training service the City Council does around employment, to being a general advocate for more jobs in the city. I think what we need to do is change the way that we've looked at economic development in the city, so it's more focused around bringing jobs into the city and bringing prosperity to people. One of the big things we've done is around apprenticeships. I'm really glad that last week we saw the first 133 apprenticeships that we've paid for as an administration go live. They'll be in place by early March. This is just the first phase, and we're going to double that number probably later on in March, and you know, take this whole initiative forward.
How do you think the cuts agenda is going to impact your particular portfolio?
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult. All areas that the council deliver which aren't statutory services, which, you know, we don't have by law, we don't have to deliver, are going to be under increasing threat. I think we need to make the very strong case that those items of expenditure and those projects which are all around developing economic resilience in Liverpool, we need to continue funding those in some way. We need to look about being more innovative about it, working with the private sector, working with other partners to, you know, to get rid of duplication and look for new ways of doing that. But, you know, jobs is absolutely crucial. If you look at some of the economic studies in Liverpool, it's saying we're going to have jobless growth till around 2013, 2014. That means we're going to see the the economy grow, but we're not going to see an increase, a significant increase in jobs. Now is precisely the time that we've got to invest in areas like apprenticeships, particularly for young people, so that we can upskill young people, make this different from the 1980s, so they can go out into the labour market, into the mainstream labour market, around the time when we're going to see that increase in jobs.
Because one of the big complaints that you still get from private sector employers is that actually there isn't the skills base sometimes within this city to fill the vacancies that do become available. So we're creating these opportunities, but often we're having to import the talent and the skill in. It sounds to me as though your job is very much at the forefront of focusing on basically filling that vacuum.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a skills gap in the city. We need around 26,000 more people at level two to get to the English average. There's also a jobs gap, though. We need more jobs in the city. We need more businesses in the city. What we've tried to do since we took control of the council back in May is to bring some of those demand-side interventions together with the supply-side interventions. As you said before, it's no good if we just invest in skills and spend public money, because we're just sending people away from the city. They'll go on the bike and they'll look for work somewhere else. Similarly, it's no good bringing businesses in unless we've got that skills base. So the two sides of the same coin on this. And what we've tried to do with bringing the new employment and skills portfolio together, and for the first time we've got one person in the cabinet whose sole responsibility is around employment. Previously it was split between three or four areas in the council. We're going to go beyond that with some of the changes we're making in the way the council's organised, bringing in business support into that so that we make employment at the heart of our economic growth policy in the city.
And again, John, just coming to you, I know we've discussed this in the past, but we've been critical, really, haven't we, in terms of the wider public sector's response, I suppose, to this whole skills agenda, because we've sunk billions of pounds into education and training, and still our city has a skills gap. It just seems incredible.
I think for too long, Frank, it became a kind of cottage industry, didn't it? The sort of the provision of training was almost an end in itself, and it wasn't being driven towards any economic end. And you know, to me, it is just startlingly positive and refreshing to hear a politician in the city talking at that level of economic literacy, because you know, for too long, whether it was being the politicians or the kind of the public sector agencies who have had these kind of responsibilities, they appear to be operating in a kind of automatic pilot, and there hasn't been a kind of informing intelligence or coherence or proactivity about the way that they've been implementing their responsibilities. So it's hugely positive to hear what Nick is leading on and how the city council is dealing with these in a very, very practical, at the same time, imaginative way.
And I suppose if there's any consolation to the challenges that you face at the moment, it is that people are having to become very focused and ensure that what is being delivered and the money that is being spent is being done so in a way that is very efficient and effective. And as John was saying there, meets the objectives that have been set.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I'm one of the things that has come out of, I mean, we're going through the budget process at the moment in the council. There are areas where we can make increased efficiencies. There are areas of duplication. We've just got to completely eradicate the duplication. I mean, I don't agree with what Eric Pickles is saying and some of what's coming out of the coalition government, but there are those opportunities to reduce inefficiencies and it focuses councils much more. It's going to be really challenging, and none of us like being in the position that we're in at the moment. And I just think what we could have achieved, had we come into power, 5-10 years ago. But we are where we are. We've got to focus on where we are at the moment, and we've got to focus to get the best possible deal that we can. For Liverpool, it has focused everyone's attention relentlessly on trying to reduce inefficiencies and eliminate duplication.
And I know when you're talking about that broader agenda, you've also been heavily involved in terms of the new relationship that's developing, or the renewed relationship, perhaps I should describe it as, that is developing between Shanghai, who the city have been twinned with for a long time, but we never seem to have done an awful lot economically with those links. The Expo I think, has acted as a bit of a springboard to change that. But not just Shanghai. I mean, China is a huge economy, a huge country. And I noticed that you've actually been looking at other cities within China that Liverpool could do business with. And I know you've been doing some work with Li Kaihong, who is the private sector champion as far as the Chinese business side of things are concerned. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, we're ambitious for Liverpool, and we've got a very strong vision for Liverpool. We want Liverpool to be the most Chinese business friendly city in the UK. What we mean by that is China became the second largest economy in the world last year. It's set to become the largest economy by around 2020. I think if we invest in and we go out to the businesses in Liverpool, we go out to the residents in Liverpool and say, look, there's big opportunities for the city here. I think that we can get ahead of the curve, and we can get, this is inevitable. The rise of China is inevitable. The impact it's going to have on the UK, on the West, is going to be hugely significant. What I think we can do is steal an advantage against some of our competitor cities in the UK and Europe, to get ahead of the game and to try and build a sustained competitive advantage in that way. Mm. So we've been working very closely with Dr. Li to try and develop some of those relationships outside of Shanghai. Shanghai is always going to be important to Liverpool's biggest city in China, 17 million people, and we've had that relationship going back 12 or 13 years now. But there's opportunities with some of the second tier cities in there, and there's some threats in what the government are doing around the regional development agencies. Something like 75% of foreign direct investment in the Northwest came through the Northwest Development Agency, only around 25% through UK Trade and Investment. We need to develop some of those links with UKTI. We're trying to do that in with the Shanghai office through the Liverpool-Shanghai partnership, but there's four other offices, UKTI offices, in China, one in Hong Kong. We need to work with the private sector to say, look, come on board on this and try and develop some dedicated Liverpool resources in those offices and to build the relationships with the business communities in those cities in China and beyond to get some advantages for our businesses here in Liverpool.
And there are some huge cities that people probably haven't even heard of. I noticed on the note that I was sent through, looking at some of the work that you've been involved with Li, Nanning, which was a place that John and I visited, it was about 6-7 years ago now, John, and never heard of it before, but what a vast city. And again, the population there was in the double figures in millions. So a massive, massive opportunity and a huge economy in terms of just the size of the thing. And what do you think Liverpool potentially could begin to get out of that relationship?
I think the big advantage that we've got in Liverpool is everyone's heard of us. When Joe Anderson went over there in October, he had a meeting with the mayor of Shanghai, Mayor Han. And when you walk into his office, there's a signed Stephen Gerrard shirt as you go in. Everyone knows what Liverpool. Everyone has. Liverpool punches above its weight internationally. We might have a negative reputation a little bit in the rest of the UK, and we're trying to deal with that. But internationally, we've got a very strong brand in there. Yeah. I think there's some big opportunities for the city in many different sectors. The big one, I think, is around creative industries. Ultimately, what China wants from the West is our creativity and our innovation and the capacity for innovation that we've got here. I think we're seen as being world leaders in the UK, and within Liverpool, we're seen as being leaders around creative industries. We need to do more about that. And people think this is all about one way. It's all about foreign direct investment into Liverpool, and some of it will be about that. But it's about much more than that. It's about challenging the businesses in Liverpool to take advantage of this, to up their game, to go out into China and to trade with China and to get a competitive advantage and to create those jobs and prosperity in the city of Liverpool through that.
And I think it's good that that's actually being actively encouraged now. And I don't think it ever has been before. The point I was making earlier, really, that Shanghai opportunity has been there for a long time and perhaps has never been grasped. I also think there are other cities in the world that would love to do business with Liverpool, and we've never really been proactive in attempting to do that. And again, I'm aware of some initiatives that are taking place at the moment that may well come to fruition internationally. But I want to turn my attention to that last one of those comments that you made there, Nick, in that our reputation in the UK mm-hmm. is not always what it should be. And I know Aurora Media have been appointed, along with Kenyon Fraser, to do some of the PR communication work around this initiative of a Liverpool embassy in London, which will be launched officially on Friday. John, again, I know this has been something that was close to your heart. You developed the idea alongside Guy Wallace last year, I think, and it's been picked up by Joe Anderson, and good on him for that. A very positive thing, and some people might say it's a strange time to be trying to sell our wares in the London market, but I tend to think it's a really good time.
I think it's a good time. And just something happened quite recently, which I think gave a little insight and a kind of practical justification for why we're doing it and why Joe was right to identify this as a priority. It was a media interview being given by Philip Hammond, Transport Secretary, about the benefits of investment in high-speed rail. And in the course of an interview, he talks about benefits that would be delivered to northern cities and business destinations in the north, and his conversations with business leaders in. And he then came out with this kind of litany of northern cities that would be the powerhouses that would benefit from this investment. And it was Leeds, it was Manchester, it was Birmingham, it was Sheffield. I think Nottingham got a mention. Glasgow was mentioned, but we were conspicuously absent from that list. And I think it is this fundamental point. I think what Capital of Culture has done, I think what Liverpool has achieved in the last few years, is that the kind of basic anatomy of its DNA, which once upon a time would have been about, I don't know, crime, deprivation. Yeah. All sorts of, you know, completely negative, has kind of been neutralised. So now it's probably about heritage, culture, creativity. But what it fundamentally isn't about is business, entrepreneurialism, aspiration, ambition, success. And that is really the message that we need to take to the London Embassy. I think we need to redefine in the minds of decision makers and influencers in the capital what the Liverpool brand is about. Mm. And surprise people in London by, you know, presenting them with a city that has got phenomenal ambitions and has got huge assets and opportunities. And just in a sense, I think the fundamental challenge, I think more than anything, is to kind of convey a sense that Liverpool is on the cusp of becoming a major driver of wealth and prosperity for the rest of the UK. It's not a city that's got its hand out. It's not a city that's dependent upon. It's not a city that's, you know, public sector dominated, but it's rediscovered what it used to be, which is a dynamic, entrepreneurial, growing, inventive, as Nick said, creative city that can be an enormous benefit to the rest of the UK and generate growth and prosperity. Yeah. And, you know, I think we've got to be really imaginative and audacious and unapologetic in the way that we present those messages in London, because I think we are dealing with, you know, a certain level of residual scepticism about the words Liverpool and business actually being, you know, conjugated in the same sentence.
Well, there's still some huge prejudices there, aren't there, in the southeast, not just against Liverpool, but we do seem to bear the brunt of an awful lot of the negativity that comes out of London. And again, you know, my own experience is that when I go to London, people are happy to talk about potential investments in Manchester. As you say, John, Leeds. When you say Liverpool, we still do have that little bit of a basket case image to get over.
I mean, I think it's leading on from sort of what John said. I mean, we've done a great job with Capital Culture in transforming people's views of Liverpool. I know loads of people who've come and visited Liverpool for the first time in many years, or for the first time in their lives, and said, look, it's completely different from how I imagined it would be. So, you know, but I think we've got to recognise that, you know, sort of the visitor economy and leisure and tourism and you know, what we've done around that, while it's been good, it's created jobs, it's created prosperity, it's created growth, it will only take us so far. We've got to get beyond that. We've got to get, you know, so Liverpool and entrepreneurialism, Liverpool and creativity, Liverpool and knowledge is much more linked. And, you know, I think if you look at what cities like Bilbao have done, you know, Bilbao was the first city around sort of 20 years ago now with the Guggenheim. Bilbao reinvented itself around culture, around the visitor economy. But there's a recognition there that, you know, they have to go beyond that. Mm. And they're now looking around sort of the digital economy and developing that as the next stage. That's where we need to be as a city. We can't just rest where we are right now.
And we don't want to develop an economy simply on tourism and the service sector, do we? We do have to have that mixed economy so that we've got the quality services that we can provide and products that we can provide here, building on the Jaguars, the Darsbury's, the...
But there are those, you know, those incredibly counterintuitive facts that you know really would make people in London sort of stand up and take notice. Like, you know, we are the second biggest centre in the UK now for wealth management. Mm. There are more scientists employed in Liverpool than the whole of Cambridgeshire. You know, the size of some of these sectors, and these are sectors which aren't peripheral to the UK economy. Mm. These are exactly the sectors that David Cameron is standing up and saying, you know, this is our economic future. These are the areas where we need to be developing an international competitive edge. Well, you know, Liverpool is right on that cusp. Mm. We could be one of the cities that is, you know, helping the UK economy to achieve that international competitive edge. And Nick's absolutely right. One of the critical things is that creativity. And it's understanding that creativity isn't just about music and culture and the light entertainment industry, but it's creativity that actually spreads across into the economy. And I think my favourite sort of paradigm city for Liverpool is San Francisco. Mm. Because, you know, here's a city that in the 70s had a kind of countercultural, post-economic identity. It had lost out to LA. It didn't really have an economic base. Its port was declining. But what it did have were lots of clever people. Mm. And lots of creative people. Mm. And, you know, in time, those clever, creative people invented Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of potential that we, and those sorts of ambitions, I think, that we should be regarding as possibilities.
It's shouting out about what we're doing well at the moment. And, you know, there's the statistics that came out last month around the employment rates. Liverpool and I think Newcastle were the only core cities in the UK which saw an increase in the employment rates. For that to happen with an economic downturn is phenomenal. Mm. It shows how resilient Liverpool's economy is. Mm. That didn't happen in Manchester, it didn't happen in Leeds, it didn't happen in Birmingham. Mm. They've all seen a decrease in the employment rate. In Liverpool, we've seen an increase. We need to be shouting about that more, what we're doing well, and building on that. Mm.
And I don't think we should be too defensive or, in fact, too downhearted about our reputation actually getting better nationally, because both David Cameron, who was over on the Wirral, I think it was only last week, and George Osborne this week have been very complimentary about the city's efforts around the business sector and the way in which Liverpool has grown. So we are starting to make some inroads into the way people's psyche is. And, you know, whatever your politics, the Prime Minister and the Chancellor standing up and talking positively about your city has to be seen as a good thing.
I mean, we want to engage, you know, constructively and positively with the coalition government. You know, I think it's great news when, you know, you've got David Cameron singing the praises of Liverpool. Mm. And, you know, it was, I think, the House of Commons a few weeks ago, you had Eric Pickles saying how what a wonderful job Joe Anderson was doing. That wouldn't have happened. I couldn't imagine that happening in the 1980s. And it shows how, you know,
Cameron was doing a good job.
It shows how we've moved on. Yes, you know, we disagree profoundly with aspects of what the government are doing. You know, we'll continue to make the case for progressive politics in Liverpool, but we need to work in a positive way with the government, because, you know, we've got to put the interests of this city behind first. And, you know, the bottom line with all of this is the challenges that we face. How do we make that different from the 1980s? Mm. What we don't want to see is a whole lost generation. We're still paying the price for that today in communities throughout this city. Mm. How do we do that? And we only do that by being grown up and mature about it.
Well, there's been a far more pragmatic approach from the administration in terms of the way it's reacted to the government agenda. And I think that's been welcomed, certainly from the business community in Liverpool. I also think that as we go forward, and this London initiative, I think it will be... interesting in terms of how it pans out, what the reaction of the London community is to that initiative. I mean, so far, when I've spoken to people, I've been down there two or three times now, I've spoken to businesses and politicians. One of the comments that's been made to me on more than one occasion is, only Liverpool could get away with this. Mm. And again, I think that's a positive thing. And I think, you know, what it reminds you of is sometimes we shy away from, some of us shy away from that old, you know, Liverpool's a bit edgy and it's a bit this. And but actually, it's part of our USP, it's part of our DNA, if you like, isn't it? And we don't want to lose that, John, do we, in terms of how you're going to market and promote this?
Frank, it's an incredible, and I don't profess to have the fully worked out solution to it, but it's an incredibly sophisticated and subtle piece of branding and tone of voice consistency that's required, because we have actually got to hold on to that, that kind of independence, that kind of creativity, that slightly rebellious capacity to innovate and pioneer and invent things without it collapsing into the flip side of that, which is the kind of stereotype that we've been saddled with for too long. But holding that middle course, or holding that brand identity and DNA, and being able to conjugate that and how to kind of articulate it through consistent messaging and tone of voice is such a fundamentally important part of the success or failure of the London Embassy. And I think so far, I think everybody's been on the same page. Everybody gets it. And I think there's been a great determination to ensure that what we're saying, how we say it, who we're saying it to, is determined and governed by some, you know, intelligent guiding principles.
And there does seem to be a genuine appreciation and an appetite from the administration to engage with the business community, but also to promote and market the city perhaps more innovatively than has been the case in the past.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we recognise as an incoming administration that, you know, we don't create jobs, it's businesses that create the jobs. If you look at some of the, whether we like it or not, you know, the government have got an agenda to rebalance the economy in favour of the private sector. You know, these are big trends that, you know, we have to accept. So we've got to do that in a positive way. I just think of, you know, some of the missed opportunities that we've had over the last 5 or 10 years around, you know, what we could have, you know, some of the private investment that we could have had into the city. You know, the view that we want is, you know, we want your investment, we want your growth. We'll put the infrastructure in place to help you achieve that. But at the end of the day, it's the private sector that's going to be creating the jobs of the future in Liverpool.
And it's that can-do attitude that we've seemed to be striving to adopt for some time and never quite got there. Are you confident that we're there now?
I think we're there. And, you know, I think, you know, you're right, it is an attitude. It's you know, we're in a process of trying to change some of the corporate culture within the city council. You know, and that's going to be difficult. You know, there's a lot of really good people in the city council, but some of the ways that, you know, local authorities have thought in the past, we just can't do that going forward. We've got to have, you know, a more, you know, can-do attitude within local authorities, but working more closely with the private sector to try and bring that investment in to grow the Indigenous businesses in Liverpool, actually to promote enterprise, to get people out there to set up their own businesses and to have a go. And, you know, it's all around, you know, this sort of, you know, I always say to people, you know, if you've never failed, you've never really innovated, you've never been innovative. We need to be innovative as a city, and that's not just the city council, it's everyone in the city.
I must be one of the most innovative people alive, the number of failures I've had to suffer in my life. But thanks for that, Nick. And on that note, that very positive note, we're drawing to a close. Congratulations to Blackpool Football Club. Good luck to Everton this afternoon. That's it from me, Frank McKenna, and City Talks Business. Thanks to my guests, John Egan and Nick Small, to my producer, Jonathan Dean. And most of all, thank you for listening. Have a great week. And don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9. City Talk 105.9. Official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm.